Third in the line of the talks. The first talk, I think you all, most of you are here, talking about meditation is very easy. And the second talk, mindfulness, also very easy. The third talk, I think overcoming obstacles is too easy. Without further delay, I think pass mic to our venerable Ajahn Prabhaso.
Very good. If it really was that easy, I would be out of a job by now. But by listening to the Dhamma, it makes it easy. So by understanding these wonderful techniques and strategies and wisdom teachings of Buddhism, you can overcome your problems and make life easy. So you get on what we call in the West Easy Street. So this today is how to get on Easy Street by letting go of all of your problems. But first of all, we have to know what is a problem and what isn't a problem. Because people are crazy these days. If they haven't got any problems, they want to make some problems. Over in the West, we have all these television programs. They're called soap operas. The things like in Australia, apparently it's called Home and Away or Neighbours. Or in England, Coronation Street. Do you have similar TV programs in Malaysia? Why do you watch such things? Haven't you got enough problems already without worrying about all these people in these in these TV programs and worrying about their problems as well? The first thing with problems is people like problems. And they don't want to let go of problems. If they haven't got any, they make problems. And when they make problems, they come and bother me and give me problems. I became a monk to get rid of problems. And what happens now? I've got rid of mine, but people come and share theirs. First of all, we should know what a problem is. And this first story, I read this in another book a long time ago. There was an American young man who was working his way across Europe, both to see the sights and also to have experience before he went back to his homeland, you know, got a job, got married and settled down. Like many young people, they would like to see the world. And if you're young, you can usually get jobs in restaurants or hotels or wherever, just to pay your way as you travel from city to city, country to country. This is what he was doing. And on this occasion, he was in the capital city of Austria, Vienna. It was a very beautiful city, but he was paying his way by working as a kitchen hand in a small restaurant in the center of the city. And working as a kitchen hand, you wouldn't get paid all that much, but you would be able to get free meals. However, one day the owner of the restaurant decided that he had over-ordered sauerkraut. Sauerkraut is a delicacy in southern Germany. It is pickled cabbage. If you're a German, you love it. If you're not, you hate it. But nevertheless, if you're poor, you can eat anything. But the problem was, the owner of the restaurant told all the staff, "We have so much sauerkraut. For the next 3 weeks, if you want to eat a free meal, it has to be sauerkraut. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, I don't care. The only free lunch you're getting here is sauerkraut." And the American got very upset. As Americans are wont to do, he started complaining. He can't do this to us. This is unfair. This is not right. Just because of his mistake ordering too much sauerkraut, it doesn't mean we have to eat it. He doesn't pay very much anyway. The only reason I'm working here is to get the free meals and a small amount of money. This is unfair. He can't do this to me. I won't stand for it. I demand my rights. He started getting angry. At which point, the cook heard him complaining and took him aside. The cook was an elderly man, and he said, "Young man," to the American, "I want to teach you the difference between a problem and an irritation." And the old cook said, about 10 years previously, he had been in a place called Auschwitz. He'd been put in there because of his religion. And every morning when he woke up, he did not know whether that day he would be chosen to go into the gas chambers and killed. Many of his relations and friends had been chosen. Every day he was waiting for it to be him. But because he was young and fit, the guards in that camp chose him to work instead. And so he survived the Auschwitz concentration death camp. When the American heard that, he thought, wow, that's a terrible experience. But what's that got to do with sauerkraut? And the cook said, "Young man, getting up in the morning, not knowing whether you're going to die that day, that's a problem. Having to eat sauerkraut for breakfast, lunch or dinner, that's just an irritation." And from that time on, that American understood the difference between a problem and an irritation. Too often when we can't distinguish between those two, we have a small irritation. Something goes wrong in our life. We did not get the promotion. We did not win on the horse racing. We did not go out with that girl you like. Or your child did not get top marks in the exam. That's just irritation. That's not a problem. So when you understand the difference between irritation and a problem, most of the things you worry about and concerned about, they just disappear. Because a lot of life is just full of irritations. Look at your husband. It's an irritation, it's not a problem. Your wife is the same. But if we overreact, it becomes an irritation, becomes a problem. We make it that way. It's really strange how the psychology of the mind, just how we amplify things. Because one of the other problems we have is these days people are just so afraid. I remember an experience when I was a young monk, because we used to face our fear. Sometimes we'd go to these jungles. And in these jungles in Thailand, 30 years ago, there were many wild animals. And those wild animals, they looked upon you as dinner. Especially a Western monk, because that was Western food. The tigers hadn't had that before. So, sometimes we'd sit in the jungles late at night just to face our fear of tigers and snakes and other things which crept through the jungle when the lights got so dark you couldn't see them. I remember once meditating there in the jungle. It's usually just after dark that the animals come out. When you couldn't see any more. And that's when I heard this sound. You could hear the sound of, through the leaves and the twigs, there was an animal coming, and coming in my direction. because I was a monk and I was mindful, I listened to that sound and said, oh, that's nothing, that's probably a small little animal. But then I listened more clearly as it became closer. And I was very, very clear that from the sound of it, and I was listening intently, from the sound of it, that was not a small animal. That was actually quite big. Because small animals don't make loud noises like that. And so I became very interested, even a bit scared. And so I paid even closer attention as it came even closer to me. It may have only been about 5 meters away from me. And then when I listened to it, that's not a small animal. That's a big animal. A tiger. Because that's what it sounded like. And having been clear that that was a tiger right in front of me, I had to open my eyes. You know what I saw? A tiny mouse. It was so embarrassing. But because of fear, I'd amplified the sound. It's amazing that this actually happens. It's a fear makes the sound of a mouse appear like the noise of a tiger coming to get you. Because that's what happens when we don't react to life with honesty and clarity, with fear. We make a big problem out of a small irritation. We make a tiger out of a mouse. It's the same like many of you are afraid of ghosts. That's why, I don't know why it is, every evening so far the front seats have been empty. They must be reserved for somebody. We always call the front seats the ghost seats. VIPs, very important phantoms. But why are you afraid of ghosts? Ghosts aren't a problem. Recently, in a house in Perth, we were called to do a ceremony for some ghosts, or a ghost rather. The thing was, it was a Thai girl married to a Catholic man. And so when they found there was a ghost in their house, they invited the priest in. And the priest did the exorcism. But you know what happened? That really pissed off the ghost. He was so upset that he was really causing problems in the house after the priest left. So that's why they called the Buddhist monks in. We came in there not to get rid of the ghost, but to pacify the ghost. Give him loving kindness. Say, ghost, the door of our house is open to you. You can stay in here if you like. That's what we did. And so the ghost is still there, but now he behaves himself. Because what's wrong with a ghost in your house? Sometimes it's nice having a ghost in the house. It's not a problem. It's not even an irritation. Because when you have friendly ghosts in your house, they're the ones who scare away the burglars. So you don't need insurance. I know I've seen some houses, they put the stickers on the outside. In this house, there are no money or valuables. Or sometimes you put the sticker on the outside of the door. This house is protected by so-and-so security. But you can put the notice on your house, this house is haunted, it's protected by a ghost, and no burglar will come near. So, it's good to have a ghost in the house, they scare off the burglars. But why is it that we make a big problem out of these things? You see, the reason is that we don't have any wisdom. The first thing we should always know is solving a problem. To know what a problem is, put it in the right category, whether it really is an irritation or a problem or no problem at all. And only deal with those things which are really problems. But the second thing with a problem is sometimes the problems are just insoluble. Like, you know, somebody has died and you're grieving for them. All the tears will never bring them back. Or someone who's failed their exams. And they think, maybe I should send a check to the Vice Chancellor or something. Whatever it is, even sort of corruption, it won't change anything. And this is actually one of the very powerful stories which I wrote in my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. And sometimes people say that these philosophies and pieces of advice from Buddhism, they might work in a monastery, but they don't work in the real world. And this was a story from the real world of politics and statesmanship. It was a story which happened, I think, in 1966 or thereabouts, 68, when the Russian Soviet army invaded Czechoslovakia. No, sorry, this was earlier, I think it was 66, when the Egyptians, Jordanians and Syrians tried to invade Israel to start what we now know as the Six-Day War. And during that time was obviously a major conflict in the Middle East and a precursor for many other conflicts in that area of the world. A reporter interviewed the former British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. He'd retired from politics, but even so, his opinion on these very crucial international affairs was so valued that a newspaper man interviewed him. And one of the first questions asked was, "Now, Mr. Macmillan, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East?" And without pausing, the former British Prime Minister replied, "Sir, there is no problem in the Middle East." Which really shocked the journalist. "How come you can say that?" said the journalist. "Don't you know there is a war going on as we speak? The Egyptian and Israeli tanks are firing live shells at each other. Many people are being killed and wounded. There's destruction, there's death. And we don't know how it's going to turn out. What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? There's a war going on, for goodness sake." And very calmly, the British Prime Minister, or ex-Prime Minister, said, "Sir, you should know that a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution to the Middle East," said Mr. Macmillan. "Therefore, it can't be a problem." Now, when I first heard that, I noted that down, because that is the words of a very wise man, of a statesman who was at the helm of international affairs for many years, whose actions and reactions affected millions of people. So let's analyze that statement. He said, "It's not a problem because there is no solution." In our life, we only have a limited amount of time, especially if you are such a senior person in the government. What he was saying is, if I waste time on a problem like that, where I cannot be effective, then I am missing out, spending my time on other problems where I can do something. Why waste the time, which I haven't got, on things with no solution? Now do you understand what a problem is? If it does have a solution, if there's something you can do about it, then yes, it is a problem. But if you can't do anything about it, it's not a problem anymore. If only we understood that, our life would be far more simple. If you're bankrupt, it's not a problem. You can't do anything about it now. If you're dead, that's not a problem. If there's something you can do, then it's a problem. So investigate, first of all. Is there something I can do? And if there's nothing you can do, it's not a problem. Which brings on to the other story in the Opening of the Door of Your Heart book, which I found very effective and which people have thanked me for, because, again, it solves the problems in your life. It's a story of one of the fellow teachers when I was a school teacher for 1 year in UK. Sometimes I tell people that if you're a school teacher, especially in a high school in the West, Just teaching those teenagers for 1 year is enough to make anybody leave the world and become a monk. And that's what I did. But one of my fellow school teachers, who was the head of the English department, once told me a story from his experiences as a soldier in the British Army during the Second World War. He was posted to Burma. And in the jungles of Burma, one day with a small group of soldiers, they stumbled in to the middle of a huge number of Japanese troops. They had a scout who came back and informed them all of the dire situation. They were completely surrounded and heavily outnumbered, at war with the Japanese in a foreign country. He told me that his initial reaction was actually quite surprised him. He thought he was going to die, but he decided to be a hero. "Let's try and fight our way out," he suggested, "even though the chances of anyone getting through are so small. Who knows, if you don't try, no one gets through. And even if we all die, at least we can take some of the enemy into death with us. We're soldiers after all. We're men. That's what courageous men are supposed to do. Let's try and fight our way out." But his commanding officer, a captain, said, "No. We're not going to fight our way out," he said. "Instead, we're going to have a cup of tea." It was the British Army, after all. But even though it was the British Army, this young Englishman thought his captain had been too long out in the sun, that he was crazy, because sometimes the heat does that to you. How can you think of having a cup of tea when you're surrounded by enemy soldiers at war, heavily outnumbered, about to die? What a crazy thing that was. But orders are orders, especially in the army, in particular at war. He had no choice. Even though he thought it was the craziest thing to do, he started making a cup of tea with his fellow soldiers. He told me in this staff room at a school in the west of England, he told me that before he'd finished drinking the tea, the scout came back, whispered something into the captain's ear. The captain told all of the soldiers, the British soldiers, "Quick, put the stuff away. The scout has just noticed the enemy has moved. There's a way through. Quick." And they all packed their stuff very quietly and quickly and crept through the open gap in the surrounding enemy. And they all escaped, every one of them, unharmed. He said he owed his life on that occasion to the wisdom of his captain. And he's repeated that strategy many times in his life since. Whenever he was like completely surrounded with death or even worse on all sides, whether it was divorce, bankruptcy, cancer or whatever, whenever there was nothing to do, he learned how to sit down and relax and have a cup of tea and wait for the situation to change. And the situation always does change. In Buddhism we call it anicca, impermanence. Life is always in flux. And what we need to solve problems is sometimes to wait. Have a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, or if you like, a bowl of your favorite noodles. Whatever it is, just rest and wait. And successful people, the survivors, The wise ones are the ones who know when it's not a problem, because there's nothing you can do, and that's when you rest and have your cup of tea or your noodles. Now, when is the time to act? When there's something to do, then you give it everything you've got. And that's how you survive the problems of life. Too often we don't know how to leave things alone and let them be. And it's when we act at the wrong time, we make matters so much worse, instead of just leaving them alone and waiting to see what happens. It's only when we can learn how to rest and leave things alone and wait, only then do we become great problem solvers in life. There's nothing to do, just enjoy the moment. Something to do, then it's a problem. You've got a solution, give it a go. So this is how we use this great Buddhist wisdom to actually solve many of the ordinary problems in life, and to choose the problems where we can be effective, and just put aside those problems which we can do nothing about, or those simple irritations where, instead of actually trying to solve the problem, we can just bear with it. But look at me, even as a monk, sometimes life is very irritating. Too often I don't get the food I like. Sometimes if I get the food I like, somebody comes along and says, "Ajahn Brahm, I've made this specially for you, please eat this." So I can't eat what I like, I eat what you like. In Thailand it's very irritating, because in Thailand they have the idea that whatever food they give a monk, if that monk eats that food, then that's the food they will get when they go to heaven. So they don't give me what I like. They come along and get their favourite food, they put it on my plate or in my bowl and say, "Ajahn Brahm, eat this." So they give me tummy ache, I say. So it doesn't matter, be compassionate, because if you eat it, then I'll get it every day when I go to heaven. That happened to me once, that somebody gave me some durian. I don't mind durian, but I didn't fancy durian that day. Because I left it, oh, they complained afterwards. That's really uncompassionate of Ajahn Brahm. He didn't eat my durian, that means I can't eat durian when I go to heaven. Oh, he was very upset. But that's just an irritation, it's not a big problem in life. And so please, the problems you have in life, please keep them quite in perspective. And when you can do something, we give it everything we've got. But again, I'm going to focus more on the letting go, letting be type of problem solving, because too often we don't know how just to rest and just conserve our energies and wait. There is a very famous old Buddhist story of an emperor, a very young emperor. And this young emperor, when he took over the kingdom, like every kingdom, sometimes things go well, sometimes there are problems in life, that's just life. No life goes smooth all the time. But being young and inexperienced, when things went well, he would celebrate and have a party. And when things didn't go well, when there were troubles and problems in the country, he'd get so depressed, he'd stay in his room and just do nothing, and sulk. Because of that, the young emperor was ineffective. He didn't do any work, he didn't govern. He was either partying or getting depressed. Now, when you're an emperor, you know, your advisors and senior ministers, they've got to be very careful what they say to you. If they upset you, then you can execute them or whatever. So the ministers, they had to find some strategy to help their emperor be more balanced, so he didn't get so upset when things went wrong, he didn't get so excited when things went right. And what they did, they met together, they decided to give the emperor what's now known as the emperor's ring. A very simple gold ring, except that on the outside of that ring, in very clear engraving, was written the words, this too will pass. And they gave that to the emperor, and the boy had to put it on his finger, and he looked at it many times each day. And what happened was, when there was a problem, he always remembered that even if he didn't do anything, this too will pass. And that never made him, that helped him not get so depressed. It's like the story I've written in my book, when I was very, very sick with typhus fever in Thailand many years ago. In my first year in Thailand, in this monastery, there were these little ticks in the forest which carried the typhus fever, the scrub typhus bug. The local villagers were immune because they'd grown up there, but the Western monks visiting for the first time, nearly all of us got typhus fever. And it was very, very unpleasant having scrub typhus. Now, in this third world hospital in the northeast of Thailand 32 years ago, because I remember the first night I was in that hospital, having a fever for many days, you feel very weak and very tired and very aching all over. And in a ward, the monk's ward in Ubon Hospital in the northeast of Thailand, I noticed that at 6 p.m. the nurse left his station, and the night nurse never arrived. When it came to about 7 o'clock, I told a monk in the next bed to me, "Shouldn't we do something? The night nurse isn't here. There's no one looking after us." And the monk in the next bed told me, "In this hospital there is no night nurse. If anything happens to you in the night time, that's just bad karma." That did not reassure me. It made me even more scared. So for 12 hours of the day, or even more, there was no nurse looking after you. You just left there, alone. No doctors, no nurses. But when actually the nurses did come, actually I preferred when there were no nurses, because I had a fever, they decided to shoot me up with antibiotics. They didn't know what fever it was, so they had a cocktail of antibiotics. And those were the days when you did not have one-use needles. All the needles were recycled. And I was convinced, because this was a third world country, and this was the remote area of that third world country, the poor area, I was convinced that the needles were used in the Bangkok hospitals first of all. When they couldn't use them for the rich people in Bangkok, then they sent them up to the provinces. And so they were used on the ordinary people, the lay people in Ubon Hospital, and last of all, they were recycled on the monks, because we were supposed to be the tough guys. I don't know if that was true, but those needles, they were really blunt. Because the nurse who would come in twice a day, in the morning and in the afternoon, to inject me in the buttocks, she was a huge lady. She was built like a Thai water buffalo, because she had to be that strong. They didn't inject, they stabbed, bang. Oh, that hurt. Even though I was a monk, a tough monk, after a couple of days, my buttocks were so sore. Whenever I saw that nurse coming, "Oh, not her again, please." It's worse than going to the principal. So I felt terrible, you know, in that hospital. And I was there for about 3 or 4 weeks, and the fever never abated. And one day, you can imagine what it's like, you know, as like, especially like a Westerner, being in a foreign land in a hospital, and having a bad fever and feeling terrible and having sore bum at the same time. My master Ajahn Chah came to see me. As soon as he came in, you know, you lift up, this was a famous monk. And I was only like a young monk, you know, he had many disciples, I wasn't special. But he came to see me. And straight away, you know, all my sadness and depression and pain all lifted, because you were visited by a famous person. He came to see me. Wasn't that really so compassionate and nice? Like, you know, when you get visited by someone you don't expect, that really lifts your spirits. And it lifted my spirits. Ajahn Chah opened his mouth. All Ajahn Chah said was, "Brahma Wangso, You'll either get better or you'll die. And then he left. Thank you very much, Master. That didn't help me at all at first. But you can't fault that advice, isn't that true? Doesn't matter how sick you are, it doesn't last. You either get better or you die. So what's the problem? He was teaching me about this wonderful impermanence. This too will pass. So when things aren't going well, sometimes even that's not a problem. Sometimes the best thing to do is just to wait. Leave it alone, things change, and the whole problem, in hindsight, was not such a big problem after all. I remember giving counseling once in Australia to a 14-year-old girl. Her father called me and said he'd tried so many other psychologists and counselors, and no one had managed to solve his daughter's problem. His daughter was depressed, her schoolwork was suffering, and she was withdrawn. She was in trouble. So I agreed to counsel her. Her father brought her into my temple in Perth one day, and I looked at her and said, "Now what's your problem?" You know what her problem was? She said she had a big nose. Now, before I was a monk, I was a scientist, a theoretical physicist from Cambridge University. So I decided to be rational. I just estimated the size of her nose, in centimeters, and I compared it to all the women's noses I'd known in my life. And I told her, I said, young man, no, your nose isn't big, it isn't small, it's not the prettiest nose I've seen, but it's certainly not the ugliest, it's an average nose. But unfortunately, that she would not take that. She left as depressed as when she came, because she thought she had a big nose. And that was making her whole life suffering and pain. And after that, I decided another simile to show what a problem is and how to overcome the problem. How big is my hand? My hand is now so big I can't see any of you, nor can I see anything else. All I can see is my hand. Is that the problem, having a big hand, or is it just because I'm not getting the proper perspective? When I put my hand where it belongs, at the end of my arm, I can still see my hand. It hasn't disappeared, got smaller or bigger, but it means I can see each one of you as well, and I can see the rest of life. Now, in that simile, her nose was so close to her, I'm not physically, but emotionally, that's all she could see, and she could see nothing else of the rest of life. And this is the problem with people, that sometimes the difficulties we face, we take them out of all proportion, they're so close to us we can't see anything else, and because of that, we suffer. So a lot of times, problem solving is just getting the perspective. Sure, it's a problem, but so what? There's many other things which are happening in your life. Don't just focus on the thing which went wrong. Too often people focus on what went wrong and they forget what went right. I've been telling business leaders in the last couple of years that if you look at the past and try and fix up the mistakes, thinking that you will learn from your mistakes, you're wasting a big opportunity, because you don't learn from your mistakes as well as you learn from your successes. Why don't we look at the past and see what worked? And learn from that. And repeat that. If it worked in the past, it's liable to work again. But we don't learn from successes. We just focus on the mistakes and think we're going to learn from that. In business, in life, even in Chimpaka Buddhist Lodge, you will learn much more from your successes, what went right, what worked, than you ever learned from your mistakes. But our usual way of dealing with problems is learning from the mistakes, going over them again and again and again and again, and at that time we forget the successes. Like that emperor, whenever things went wrong, he looked at the ring, this too will pass, but he also looked at the ring when things were going well. He learned from his successes as well, and he always remembered, no matter how much prosperity, happiness you have, that too is fragile. It can break at any time. See this cup here. This cup is ceramic. If I drop it, it will break. My teacher Ajahn Chah would often use this simile. He'd pick up a glass and he'd ask us, can you see the crack in this glass? And I'd look and say, there is no crack in the glass. He said, there is a crack there. It's called a potential crack. One day, it's going to open up when you drop it or you kick it. It's there, just waiting to happen. The potential crack. And he said, because it's got that crack in it, that's why you have to care and look after it. If it didn't have the crack, if it was made of unbreakable plastic, you wouldn't need to care about it. You can drop it, kick it, do whatever you like. He said that's the same with life. For example, with relationships, with success, with people. All things have got potential cracks in them. Your health, your happiness, even your life. One day, that will open up. One day you'll die. One day things aren't so economically well. When you realize there's always a crack in your happiness, that this too will pass, that is why you care. It's the preventative actions which keep the good times lasting longer and longer. If you're married and got a wonderful wife or husband, you don't take them for granted. There's a crack there somewhere. And don't hit your husband on the head to find it. Know it's there. And care. Because if you don't put care into your marriage, it will soon break. Put care into the relationship you have with your children. It's impermanent. It can change at any time. Be careful of your health. There's a crack there too. So that's why you care for your body. You care for your loved ones. You care for your country. You care for life. Once you know this too will pass. So that's preventative measures to stop problems arising in the first place. But no matter how wise you are, how proactive you are, there'll always in life be problems. And there are some problems which you can't overcome. So what do? You've got the right perspective, yeah, it's the end of, there's other things in life other than this problem. I can see that you know it will pass, but it's still you've got to deal with it. So how do you deal with the terrible problems in life? The story which I've said many times, having a problem is like going home from the temple and treading in the dog poo. Have you ever trod in the dog poo and got it all over your shoes? My advice to you If you ever tread in dog poo, never scrape it off your shoes. Always take it home with you. And when you take it home, please dig it under the mango tree in your back garden. If you haven't got one, find someone else who's got a mango tree and dig it under their mango tree. Because you will find 1 year later, the mangoes on that tree will be sweeter than ever before. But also remember that when you eat that mango and it tastes so sweet, please remember what you're really tasting. Dog poo! Transformed. And the moral of that story is, when you have a problem, embrace it, make use of it, and transform it. Because the problems which we cannot get rid of in life are the fertilizer of compassion and wisdom. I often tell people the same story. If you haven't had pain in your life, you don't know how to be kind. If you haven't really had disappointment, tragedy even, you haven't learned the source of compassion. I know some people who've had very fortunate lives. Their parents have been wealthy. They've been intelligent, handsome, beautiful, talented, and they've gone through life with no problems at all. But they don't know how to be kind, because they never suffered and had problems to deal with themselves. When you've really suffered, and you've gone through a divorce, a tragedy like a death, or you lost your business because someone's cheated you or whatever, if you've really been through suffering and come out the other side, then you know how to care. The pain of life is a seed of compassion and kindness. And it also is a fertilizer for wisdom. When you understand that, you actually can embrace the difficulties and problems of life. You see, they actually have a purpose. They're here to teach you. Going back again to when I was a school teacher, if I set examinations and every child in the class got full marks, that would be a bad test. If I set an exam and no one got an answer right, that would also be a bad test. A good test is when children maybe get 60% or 70%, but everyone makes a few mistakes. Because that's the only way that we can test our weaknesses and learn and grow. So life is like those examinations. You will be tested, and don't always expect to get top marks and pass every time. If you did pass every time, there'd be no point to life. You wouldn't learn anything. It is from those mistakes that we find our weaknesses, and we can amend those weaknesses and get stronger and wiser and more compassionate. Which is why that we have to accept the pain and difficulties of life as part of this journey we call our life, where we learn and where we grow. So we don't reject things, but we embrace things. And this is actually where we come to the deeper teachings of religions like Buddhism, where we understand the suffering of life and we embrace it. We open the door of our heart to life. Not just the nice part of life, but even the painful part of life as well. Now we understand from what happens when we embrace life, when we accept life, when we're at peace with life, with the fine parts and the difficult part as well. We understand what the Buddha once said, that a problem has two parts to it. The first part of the problem is the physical part, the nature of life, old age, sickness, gain and loss, success and failure. Everyone goes through that. And you can't avoid that. The other part, and the part where you have got full control, is your reaction to the difficulties and problems in life. You can't stop the problems coming, but you can certainly learn how to react to them with more wisdom, with more peace. And this is where you have full power. You cannot change the world, but you can change the way you look at the world. In the Eightfold Path, we call that right intention. The second factor of the Eightfold Path. I mention this because somebody asked me in an interview today about right intention. What is it? The intention to let go, to renounce, to give up, not to carry the problems around with you. I know sometimes people, that something went wrong in their life and they go and tell everybody, they can't let it go. They keep carrying around the problems of their past like so many coffins of dead, terrible things piled on top of their head. No wonder they get headache. So whatever's bad happened in the past, why can't we let it go? Why can't we renounce it? When we say renouncing, many Buddhists think that means becoming a monk or a nun. But you don't have to become a monk or a nun. Just renounce all that stuff of the past. Who did what to who, when and how. So you can be free. Another story. Just thinking when I told this last, whether it was, I don't think it was here. There were two Australian soldiers. Again, these were veterans of the Second World War. But they had been in the Malaysian Peninsula and they were captured by the Japanese at the fall of Singapore. And they were put in a POW camp. And many of you know the terrible things which happened both in Singapore and also in the POW camps. And these two ex-soldiers met together after many years at a reunion. And when they met and said hello, one said to the other, "Have you forgiven the Japanese yet for what they did to us during the war?" And his friend said, "Never. How can you forgive what those monsters did? Those Japanese prison guards, what they did to me and our friends. We saw so many of our friends tortured and killed and made to work in horrible conditions. I can never forgive those Japanese, never. What about you?" And his friend said, "Mate, I forgave those Japanese many years ago. You, my friend, are still living in the POW camp." Now that's a powerful story, because until, it was a terrible time, it was a problem, you don't deny that, but until he lets it go and forgives, he's allowing the problem to continue in perpetuity. He's still in the camp being tortured. It's like when the old story, when people call you an idiot. Has anyone ever called you an idiot? And what do most people do when you're called an idiot? You think, "Why did they call me an idiot? They had no right to call me an idiot. I won't stand for being called an idiot." And every time you remember it, you allow them to call you an idiot one more time. Now you understand that. So why can't we say they call me an idiot and just drop it? Forget about it. They were wrong. It's only when we carry around those problems that we don't know what renunciation, letting go, really means. So hopefully those of you who meditate can actually practice and learn to let go of things. Let go and free yourself from the POW camps of your life, the places where you've been tortured and hurt. Unfairly, you let go of your problems. As far as the problems of the future are concerned, how many of you are worried and concerned about something which might happen? Many years ago I learnt about fear, even when I was a young kid, a young boy. One of the things I didn't like was going to the dentist. In those days, the dentists were quite cruel and fierce and very painful. And so I had a dentist appointment the following day, and I hardly slept that night. I was only a small fellow, because I was afraid of going to the dentist the next morning. And when I got up in the morning, I was pleading with my mummy, "Don't send me to the dentist, I don't want to go to the dentist, mummy, please be kind." But mummy sent me to the dentist. And as soon as I got to the dentist surgery, it was only then that I found out my appointment had been cancelled. Why do we worry so much about things which usually don't happen anyway, or they turn out to be something different? Please don't make a problem about the future. You don't know what's going to happen next, so give it the benefit of the doubt. So that's called renouncing. And the other thing, we always have a problem, we think too much. And most people, they come and see me, and they bother me for hours and hours and hours. And why? Because they're thinking too much. Just shut up and don't think about it. It probably won't happen anyway. But because we think about it too much, that is why the problem is. The story about this was, again, for my first couple of years in Thailand. My master Ajahn Chah was building a big hall, the Holy of Holies, the ordination hall, the main Dhamma hall in his monastery. And we were involved in the building. And after the building was completed, because it was a flat area of land, he actually raised it on a small hill. Some of you may have been there and seen that hill, and I was responsible for some of that. But after the building was completed, I had a huge pile of earth left over. And so Ajahn Chah called all the monks together and said, "The earth is all over the place. I want you to collect it all and put it right over there, in the back of the building, in the forest slightly, where no one can see it." Now that was a huge pile of earth. And it was going to take us a long time to move it. In fact, it took 3 days. And this was, we only ate one meal a day, which was finished about 9:30. About 9:45 we were shoveling and pushing wheelbarrows. And we didn't finish until about 8-9 o'clock. When it got dark, we had the lanterns out to help us. And so there I was, a Westerner, not used to the hot jungles, working, pushing barrows in the hot, steaming, mosquito-ridden jungles of northeast Thailand on one meal a day. It was hard work, and so tough and sweaty, and you were tired at the end. But I had faith. It was for your teacher, your master. So I didn't mind. I'd give it 3 days and give it my best. And after the third day, we were finally finished. And of course you felt so good. You've made a lot of good karma, you've helped your master, you've made help build this monastery, many people will come there and enjoy it afterwards, and I went to sleep very content, especially knowing that the following morning I could get back to my meditation and have a rest. But that night, Ajahn Chah left for another monastery to visit there. And so the following morning, after our one meal of the day, the deputy abbot, now in charge, called all of our monks together and said, "I think we put it in the wrong place. Let's move the earth over here." This was a test of my faith, but I still had faith. So I said, okay, and he's got a point actually that, you know, it did look better where he suggested. So for another 3 days, we shoveled and pushed wheelbarrows in the steaming hot mosquito-ridden jungles of northeast Thailand, being sweaty, covered in mosquito bites, tired and dirty. Another 3 days I worked really hard, but we finally finished. And that was a huge relief. 6 days working like that in a row, you feel very, very tired. You need to wash your robes. They haven't been washed yet. You've been working all day. You're tired. You have other things you have to do. So I look forward to the following morning, I can take a good break. But that night, Ajahn Chah returned. Following morning, he called the monks together. I told you to put the earth over here, you put it over there. Move it. And that was the time that I lost my faith. They can't do this to me. The senior monks, they don't push the wheelbarrows, it's the junior ones have to do all the work. Why can't they decide where they want this bloody earth? I'm not standing for this, this is not good enough. I'm trying to be an actor now, as I said the other day. So I was really upset. But we had to push those wheelbarrows. 3 days of hard work were in front of me. And I started swearing. I swore in English, thinking the Thai monks would not understand me. But obviously they didn't understand the words, but they sure knew the body language. They knew I was really upset. And that was when one of the monks came and gave me a Dhamma teaching, which I remembered for the rest of my life, and I've shared with many people. Practical Dhamma which changes your life. He came up to me and just said, Brahma Wangso, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. It was true. When I stopped thinking and complaining, the wheelbarrow got lighter. And once again, it was an act of faith and joy. And the 3 days went very quickly. What I learned from that is thinking about it is always the hard part. Doing it is easy. And how much of life do we think and make a huge problem when actually doing it is easy, the thinking is the hard part. So renounce your thoughts, just do it. As I say, this talk this evening is sponsored by Nike. Just do it. And the other parts of right intention, I've gone over time so I'll go very quickly. The other parts of right intention, the Buddha's advice on the path to enlightenment, is having intentions of kindness. So be kind to your problems. They've come to teach you some important lessons. And also be gentle to your problems. Non-violent. And if you don't react to problems with hatred and violence, they get solved pretty quickly. That's straight down the line, second part of the Eightfold Path. Look it up yourself. That's how we deal with the problems of life and transcend them. By letting go of past and future, letting go of thinking, just doing it. Being kind, compassion, and being gentle. I wish more people were gentle in their life and compassion to life, able to embrace life as it is with kindness. Compassion doesn't mean liking the nice part. Compassion means the door of my heart is open no matter what comes along. A mother loves her child even if her child misbehaves. It's the unconditional loving kindness which now you use towards your life. At the end of your life, those things you thought were big problems, you look back and you realize just how they were part of your journey and how there were opportunities to learn so much and grow so fast. I remember as a school kid Some of my teachers were very fierce. I never liked them, but I learned the most from them. Now when I look back, the soft teachers, I think were a waste of time. It's the ones I didn't like. They're the ones where I learned. It's the same in life. When you're right in the problem, you don't like it. But afterwards you realize, those are the ones which are really important. Many, many, many people who I've counseled for cancer, have gone through to remission, have told me, and that's the reason I say this, they told me that the cancer was the best thing which ever happened to them. At the time, it was a problem. On the other side, they learned so much, they grew so far. What a wonderful blessing that was. This is what we mean by embracing the problems of life. A lot of times you've got no choice, so why not try that way? And then you have transcended the problems of life. So that's the talk for tonight. So we now have the question time. That's a problem for me. I'm now going to transcend them by answering them. So anyone who's got some more questions, you can please put them on the piece of paper. Have they got any live questions? Yesterday we had a very courageous lady who's going to become a professor in her next life. Anyone else want to become a professor? A doctor? Okay. I'll do the first question here. Besides meditation, is there any other ways to cultivate mindfulness? Okay, meditation is the best way to cultivate mindfulness. But there are other ways, but they're not as good. Is there any other way to make money other than going to work? It can be, like stealing or playing lottery or whatever, but that's very uncertain. You're liable to lose more than you gain. So meditation is the best way to get mindfulness. And can mindfulness lead us to nirvana? Of course it can. But do you know what nirvana is? Who knows what nirvana is? Who's going to say a pop group? So nirvana was a pop group. They lived in Seattle some time ago. Anyway. So yes, mindfulness. But mindfulness alone doesn't lead you to the freedom from suffering. You have to do the whole of the Eightfold Path. So mindfulness is one factor. So this is what you need to do to become enlightened. My son, who is 20 years old, wants to be a monk. I said no. Oh, why not? You must finish your study in Germany first. Is it the right thing for me to do? This is a bit of a misogynist joke, but I'm going to say it anyway. What's the difference between a diplomat and a lady? If a diplomat says yes, they mean maybe. If they say maybe, a diplomat, they mean no. If a diplomat says no, they're not a diplomat. If a lady says no, she means maybe. If she says maybe, she means yes. But if she says yes, she's no lady. So you should be diplomatic. Instead of the son says, you want to be a monk, and you said no, you say, I'll think about it. It's like my new book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. I told people the other day, or someone actually wanted to buy it. I said that anyone who buys that book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, if you don't get enlightened after reading that book, you can ask for your money back. But I never said, if you get your money back, you only can ask for it, that's all. So you don't need to say no, you can say maybe. And that way you don't upset people. And it's true, because you say, well, maybe not now, but leave it open in the future. You can say, if you do well in your studies, then we'll consider it. So that's a wise thing to say, like to your wife. Never say no, say I'll think about it. Yeah. Have you thought about it yet? Well, I'm still thinking. So anyway, yeah, the right thing for you to do. It's good to finish your studies first of all, because to be a monk you have to obviously have commitment and be able to bear with things and continue things to the end. And people who usually just give up their studies, they become a monk, they give up being a monk as well. And then they go and get married and they go and give up their wife. They keep giving things up. And that's not renunciation, that's stupidity. Is it bad karma to discourage people to feed pigeons because the shit causes disease? No, the shit causes delicious mangoes. What about treatment of termites? Okay. Obviously you have to be kind to the animals. In other words, compassion has to be with wisdom. If you feed pigeons with food which is not good for them, that's not really helping them at all. Now, in a park I visited in Perth a few weeks ago, they had a big sign saying, don't feed the ducks, and they had a picture of a dead duck on the advert, because that's what happens when people feed them human food. So instead of feeding the pigeons, you can always feed the monks. Or you can feed the poor people. Or go and get a cat and feed that. And treatment of termites, that if you build a proper house and you have things like termite mesh or other things which actually stop the termites coming in the first place, you don't have to treat them. Why aren't my prayers... this is a great question. Why are my prayers not answered? You can imagine that the switchboard up in heaven is jammed. No wonder you can't get through. Have you ever tried ringing up MAS? It's much worse up in heaven. So instead of making your prayers, do something about it. Instead of... That's why some people ask, what's the best way to get rich? Not praying. If you're praying, you're wasting time. The best way to be rich is work hard and spend little. People don't want to hear that though. How do I make my prayers heard? Okay. So you're wasting your time. You can make affirmations, because when you make a prayer on affirmation, you also hear it. And find out if your affirmation is really a wise one. If your affirmation is, may I win the lottery, that's a stupid affirmation. Because as soon as you win the lottery, you'll be in big trouble. All your friends will be coming around to try and bother this and bother that. Have you actually seen stories of people who win lotteries? I mean, one story about 2 years ago, there was a fellow in the United States, he won the biggest lottery ever won, something like 111 million or something. The full prize was $1 billion, but the tax office took most of it and they settled for 111 million US. And the reason he was in the paper, 6 months later he'd been arrested and was put in jail for about 20 years. Before then, he was a well-balanced, average, happy person. Not rich, but had lots of friends. As soon as he got the money, then the problem started. So if you're going to pray for something, be wise. And pray for something which is useful. And may all beings be happy and well. Or, you know, may some poor people get a bit more food to eat. And once you make an affirmation, you find actually you can help that affirmation come true by going out and doing something. So a prayer should really be a reminder to you of your duties and responsibilities and how you can actually help in this world. So the prayer is only the beginning of your action to make that prayer, that hope, that dream come true. But you can't wait for it to come true. You've got to make it come true. It's up to you. So if you just pray and don't do anything, then the prayer isn't fulfilled. If you lost faith in Buddhism, what and how do you overcome this feeling? Whatever you lost, you can always go to the lost property office. It's fine. Is anyone handed in Buddhism, please? Because I lost it today somewhere. You can lose your faith in Buddhism. You can lose your faith in Christianity. You can lose your faith in religion. But please, please, never lose your faith in forgiveness, goodness, and love. So have faith in what these religions are supposed to represent. This is the problem with some religions in this world. 2 or 3 years ago, there was a big commotion in the world because the US Marines in Guantanamo Bay were accused of flushing a copy of the Quran down the toilet. A couple of days later in Perth, at a talk just like this, someone asked me, Ajahn Brahm, what would you do if somebody flushed a copy of a Buddhist holy book down the toilet? Say like the Dhammapada. What would you do if they flushed a copy of the Dhammapada down the toilet? And I said, without pausing, if someone did that, I'd call a plumber. We're very practical. But certainly, I wouldn't mind a book being flushed down the toilet, but I'd never allow Buddhism to be flushed down the toilet. In other words, I would never allow anyone to destroy peace, forgiveness, virtue, compassion. But if I got angry at someone who did that, then I would allow someone to destroy Buddhism. Buddhism, religion, is not the book. It's what's in the book. So you always must distinguish the container from the contents. The container in Buddhism is the book, the monks, the temple, the Buddha statues. That's containers. You can blow up a Buddha statue, you can destroy the temples, you can even kill monks. But please don't get angry and allow someone to destroy compassion and peace. When you know the difference between the container and the contents, it's okay to lose faith in the container called Buddhism, but please never lose faith in peace and forgiveness, compassion, fellowship, love, gentleness. And then you will always have faith in what all religions share. And that's the most important. We have different containers with all the religions in our world. But if you really go deep, go way beyond the containers to the contents, you'll find what we can share together in harmony. So, okay, you can lose your faith in Buddhism, but never lose your faith in forgiveness, peace, friendship, compassion and love. How should one maintain good mindfulness in one's daily life amidst one's busy schedule daily? Again, I've been teaching lots of business people recently, and I say, look, a busy person is not a person who has many things to do. A busy person is someone who does too many things at the same time. Have a look upon that. There's a lot of truth in that. A busy person is someone who does too many things at the same time. In other words, you can actually get a lot of things done without being busy. And I've seen people like that. That you look at them and they're just working. They're working continually, gradually, consistently. And at the end of the day they get so much done.
other people, they're rushing around all over the place. They look like they're doing a lot, but their output is very small compared to the other guy. So to be efficient and to get your work done, try and do one thing at a time and do it well. And only then go to the next thing. Then it's called mindfulness, efficiency. You don't get so stressed out. You may not look busy, but you get more done. A busy person is someone who does too many things at the same time. So mindfulness training, you just do one thing at a time. How to practice mindfulness in daily life? Just like that. The question is not on mindfulness, but I always wondered whether intelligence can exist. Oh, I did this one already yesterday. Noted that mindfulness and taking time to appreciate the finer things in life might bring about contentment and happiness. In an economically driven world, is it possible to slow down when the environment dictates that speed and accuracy takes precedence, when employers keep pushing for more? No. Employers want you to be efficient, want to get lots of things done. The problem with modern business is they don't know what efficiency is. And they just look at hard work, how many hours you're spending at the office, instead of what your output is, and the quality of your output. And I told you, I think yesterday, in April I'm going to be teaching CEOs and Vice Presidents in London at the 2007 Human Resources and Development Conference. 2,000 delegates, business leaders from around Europe are going to be told what I'm telling you now. In an economically driven world, to get the competitive edge, you have to be smart, efficient. In other words, you can't afford to have people making mistakes in your office. And when do you make mistakes? When you're rushing too fast. There's an old saying, there's not much time, therefore we must go slowly. Brilliant slaying. Because when there's not much time, it means we can't afford to make mistakes. Because every mistake takes a long time to correct. So if there's not much time, you can't afford to make mistakes, therefore you've got to go slowly. I remember when we were building our monastery, we had to do some explosive works to get rid of a rock. And so we had the explosive experts, you know, putting the charges in the rock and lighting the fuse. And he gave us an important piece of advice. He said, when I light the fuse, you've got to go away, but do not run. Because it's when people run away from an explosion that's when the accidents happen, they trip over, and that's when they die. You never run, you walk. When there's not much time, you have to go slowly, because that's going carefully. It's the same in business. If you've got lots of things to do, you have to do it carefully, which means slowly, not too fast. There really should be speed cameras in the office. And anyone who works too fast should get fined, because people who drive too fast have accidents. Can you please share with us the 10 parameters in a proper sequence? My goodness, I have to do that another day because that's too long. Can you teach us an easy meditation method we can use daily? I did that yesterday. Where were you? What is the highest form of merit? The highest form of merit is being here now. There appears to be so much hatred between the West and the Middle East, resulting in senseless killing. Is that a problem? What is the Buddhist solution to this quarrel? Again, if there is something you can do something. But one thing we can do is at least we can, in our home, in our societies, we can actually be peaceful. And we can do little things. If the problem is between religions, such as the Islamic community in Palestine and the Jewish community in Israel, actually can't we actually lead by example of how religions can actually really live in harmony and peace together? Because that's one of the biggest problems in the world. And to be able to have religions living in peace and harmony in the world, we've got to meet each other, and we have to not argue over our differences, but find the common ground first of all. It's the common ground where we find friendship and fellowship. And once we have the common ground and the mutual respect and trust, then we can discuss our differences. But if you discuss differences first, then you don't have time to establish those friendships, and discussion gets nowhere. It's the same if you find anyone of another faith who is fundamentalist, they try and convert you. There's no discussion at all. We have to have friendship first of all, and only discuss when the friendship is strong. So that friendship and fellowship should come first. That's why it's wonderful to be able to do things together. It's the walls which make the barriers between our communities. When we take those, look, because my parents were very poor, that was because my father was sick for most of his life and so couldn't really hold down a job. It was wonderful being poor. Number one, I had to grow up in a very, very small apartment. So we're always bumping into each other. We had to learn to get on because there was no place to hide. And when I went to school, it was a very poor school where there was many migrants. There was people from Jamaica, from Pakistan, from Africa, from all over. And because there were multiracial people in my school when I was growing up, I became colorblind. I don't care if someone came from Malaysia or the Congo or Trinidad, if they could kick a ball, they were on my soccer team. And that was true, I didn't mind who people were, as long as they could perform and they were good friends. And it was wonderful having friends from different races. Now, because I'm a monk, I make a point of having friends from different religions. Just to keep me in line, because if I just hang out with Buddhists all the time, I can become very narrow-minded. So I've cultivated my old friends, especially my old Christian friends from college and school. And a couple of Muslim friends as well. Because without them, I wouldn't get proper feedback. So we can make those bridges. And one of the nice things about our modern world is we travel, we live in each other's countries, we disperse. And I think I gave a talk in Singapore a year ago, and a couple came up to me and they said, "She's a Muslim, I'm a Christian, and we love coming to hear your Buddhist talks." That's the sort of world I like to see, where we intermarry. We may have like a Christian marrying a Buddhist and having one son as a Muslim, another one who's a Sikh, another girl who's a Hindu. What a wonderful world that would be. So we can all love each other and be friends together. I think that's a wonderful thing. Already, I mean, you can have one son who supports Liverpool, another one who supports Arsenal, and they can still get along. What do we do in the face of something like the genocide in Sudan? There seems to be no solution, but doing nothing doesn't suit either. Sometimes, again, the cause is there. No, the causes are because there's one government who is an Arab Muslim government, the southerners are African Christians. It's in everyone's interest to share. There was this old cartoon I saw a long time ago. And the cartoon was of two dogs, and they were tied together by a leash to the neck. And one had a bowl of food over here, and the other one had a bowl of food on the other side. But the leash wasn't long enough, so one was trying to pull, like a tug of war, to get to their bowl of food, and the other one was trying to pull to tug and get to their bowl of food, and the leash was too short, and so they were tugging and tugging to get to their bowl of food, because they couldn't get to both foods at the same time. And that was the first frame of the cartoon. The next frame of the cartoon was the two dogs having a light bulb over their head, an idea. And the third cartoon frame was the two dogs going to one bowl first of all and eating it together, and then the last frame they went to the other bowl and ate it together. When they worked together, then they could both have a full stomach. And that's just so often the case with conflict. There's an old story of two women who were fighting over an orange. One said, "You had it last time, it's my turn." "No, you didn't, it's my turn. I want the orange." "No, it's my turn, I want the orange." So they decided to have a compromise. They cut the orange in half. So the first woman peeled the orange, threw the peel away, and ate the flesh. The second woman peeled her orange, threw the flesh away, and kept the peel because she was making a cake. If they'd only told each other what they wanted the orange for, one could have had a whole orange to eat and a whole lot of peel for their cake. Get the picture? So let's find out what we really want, first of all, and then the problem could be solved. I heard about the forgiveness shown by Amish in the US for the killing of schoolchildren in their community. Could you elaborate more on their wonderful example? These are religious people, like Buddhists should be, like Sikhs should be, like Muslims should be. If someone has hurt us, isn't mercy, compassion more important than harming someone else? No, one of the sayings in Christianity, if they hit you on the left cheek, turn the right cheek. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing if, actually in Buddhism they say if they hit you on the left cheek, run before they hit you on the other cheek. But we don't need to hit anybody back. It's a revenge is mistaken for justice. And sometimes people say they want justice, but what does that really mean? Too often they say, "I want justice," but what they really mean, they want revenge. And revenge is not the answer. It just doubles, trebles the pain in life. So always think about that. Whenever somebody does something wrong or they hurt you and you say, "I want justice," is that what you really want, or do you want revenge? At least be clear about that. A lot of time it's revenge we want. Justice comes naturally. If you're a Muslim, Allah will sort it out. If you're a Buddhist, your karma will sort it out. If you're a Christian, God will punish you in the next life. And if you are a free thinker, you don't believe in any religion, if you do something wrong, you have to be in psychotherapy for many years to get rid of your guilt. Justice is natural. It does not need to be forced. So your job is just to forgive. You know, if someone has really misbehaved and done the wrong thing, the karmic punishment will come to them naturally. You do not need to make revenge happen. So the Amish were very good there. The best thing to do is someone's shot. Let's, what would they say, acknowledge, forgive, and then see to make sure we solve the problem so it never happens again. That's justice. To see what we can do so the problem never happens again. But that problem has happened. You can't change the death of a child. And by killing someone else, that's two deaths. But find some other way. We can make sure it never happens again. When monks get sick, do they take medicine or meditate to cure themselves? When I get sick, I try and hide it. Because if I cough in public, I get all these cough medicines, both chemical, Ayurvedic, homeopathic, Chinese medicine. I get so many medicines, and they all come up to me and say, "Ajahn Brahm, you must take this medicine. And you make me promise, and I take so much medicine, it really makes me sick." So that's why I just hide any sickness, because I'm afraid what you might give me.
So if a monk gets sick and there is medicine, you take medicine. But you don't just heal the body, you heal the mind. If there's no medicine, you just be mindful and make peace with it. You know that I'm overweight. It's all your fault, nothing to do with me. But I found, there was again research, I love science, research has shown that when you laugh, your arteries dilate, they go wider. And when you're miserable and upset, your arteries contract. So because I laugh a lot, my arteries are so wide, it actually balances the overweight which I have. And I notice in history, have you ever noticed, fat people are always jolly and happy. Because they're the only ones who survive. The fat people are miserable, they die when they're young. So there's a bit of natural selection there. So if you're overweight, you can actually balance it by laughing a lot. And then whatever health problems come from overeating is balanced by the arteries dilated and all that fat and cholesterol can run through smoothly, even though you've got more than other people because you laugh a lot. So laugh a lot. How do we see the Dhamma? Do we learn the Dhamma through people's acts and speech? The Dhamma, the real meaning of that word Dhamma is the source of things, where things come from, the origin of things. I don't mean the origin of this world, I mean the origin of you, the origin of the thought, the origin of your emotions. What's your source? What's your center? Where do you come from? Who are you? So you find the Dhamma by going in, into this moment, into this mind, into the center of things. And the Dhamma is like the source. It's this experience looking back from where it came from. That's called Dhamma. And so how do you see the Dhamma? By going deep inside. This is actually a saying from Gnostic Christianity. It's supposed to be a saying of Jesus in the Gnostic Gospels. He who knows themselves knows the truth of all things. He who knows themselves knows the truth of all things. The Gospel of Thomas the Contender, if I've got that right. Old sayings of Jesus which were found in the village of Narkamadi in southern Egypt, dating from, I think, the 1st or 2nd century, which were purged out of the Bible. And that makes sense to me. That's the sort of saying which runs across all religions, attributed to Jesus. He who knows themselves knows the truth of all things. Ajahn, how to differentiate right and wrong view? I prefer to call it skillful and unskillful view. So unskillful, is it going to actually reach your aim? So for example, you want your wife to love you and be kind to you, and it's a wrong view to get angry at her. Because it does that work, it's not skillful, it doesn't work. So use skillful ideas, skillful views. And if you have a skillful view, like all people, no matter where they've come from, have got a very beautiful part in them. In Buddhism we call this the Buddha nature. So whenever you're angry at your mother-in-law, always look at her as if she's got Buddha nature. There's a potential Buddha in there somewhere. It might be difficult to see, but it's in there, trust me. And then you can't get so angry at her anymore. It's like getting angry at the Buddha, and that's bad karma. So that's actually a skillful view, because that solves a problem. There's actually... When people ask questions on a piece of paper, from now on, I'm only going to answer one question. So if you say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I'm only going to answer number 1 because there's too many questions. And so don't do question number 1
ABC? Just the first question. Is Visuddhi Magga wrong view? No, it's not wrong view. It just, Visuddhi Magga is one of the books from the commentarial period. Nothing is right and wrong, it just depends on how you make use of it. Remember the Visuddhi Magga is another container. It's a container of teachings, it's like a buffet. When I had my food today, I never ate off every plate. I just chose what suited me for today, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and that kept me healthy. In the same way, all the teachings which you hear in your life from myself, from another monk or teacher or priest or whatever, it's a buffet of Dhamma, of teachings, of truth. Take what you like, what makes sense to you, put it to use, and if it works, continue practicing it. So Visuddhi Magga is not wrong or right, it's just a buffet. Some things you like, some things you don't like, but no need to sort of say it's wrong or right. It's the same with many religions. If there is another teacher who comes to KL or PJ, doesn't matter whether he's Christian, Sikh, Muslim or whatever, if they've got something good to say, go and listen and take what you like, which is beautiful and makes sense, practice that. Something you don't like, just leave it where it came from. When do you give up? When do you give up? When tragedy after tragedy happens, each time you let go. The tragedy concerns someone close, and when you love unconditionally. If you love them unconditionally, and it really is, there's no conditions. So there's no time limit, there's not a use by date on your loving kindness. You know, like they have on like milk or other food on the outside, best before July 6, 2007. That's called a use by date. So loving kindness does not have an expiry date on it. So that way you can love unconditionally. And when you love unconditionally, the tragedies just change into dog poo. In other words, fertilizer for your fuller growth. So you don't look upon these things as tragedies. They're opportunities. It's a wonderful thing when people get sick. Sometimes I think it's so tragic they're sick with MS, multiple sclerosis, or with these cancers or AIDS or whatever. But sometimes a sickness gives other people a chance to care for you. To show how much they love you. And sometimes being the center of people's compassion is a very inspiring time. There are many times when tragedies are transformed into the most beautiful moments of life. Where people think, how can this, when a kid is dying of cancer and they're only 6 or 7 years of age, how can that be beautiful? If you go to the bedside and just see the care and kindness and compassion and time which is given to that little being in their few weeks left of life, it can so inspire you. You wonder, this is not a tragedy, it's an opportunity which people have taken. It's just the way you look at life. And you can sometimes turn what we call a tragedy into the most beautiful thing just by changing the way you look. And that's actually what we do. So, tragedy upon tragedy, you're not looking at it in a wise way. Change attitude. How do I deal with my teenage son who is not motivated to study and has no direction in life? He only wants to play computer games. It's about time that Buddhists here in KL started a Buddhist computer game. I don't know, instead of Dungeons and Dragons, we can have work and nirvana, or whatever. I don't know, to have some computer games which have some dharma, some spirituality involved in them. And that way people may be playing a computer game, but they're learning a lot about dharma at the same time. So it's a way that we can use the way that people want to live their lives and use the culture of our modern age and to put some spiritual qualities in it, to give it a spiritual content. So kids are going to play computer games, so let's change the computer games to make them interesting. It's the same way that people want to watch movies. And for a long time now, I want somebody to actually start the movie, not Superman, but Super Monk. Because I have the script in my head of Super Monk, who can fly through the air with levitation, has psychic powers, can stop bombs going up, can actually read the mind of terrorists and save the world without violence. And at the end, you know, when you stop the terrorists blowing up the White House, Super Monk stands in front of Mr. Bush and a terrorist and teaches them metta, loving kindness meditation. What a wonderful movie that would be. But so we have to use the media of the modern age. You know that when I give a talk in Perth, it's always put on the internet. Now there's video streaming, so when I am in my hometown, which is very rare these days, and that's your fault as well, that usually about 300 people attend the talk and hear it live every Friday, 17,000 people hear the talk on the internet. Because it's put straight onto the internet. And some of the people who hear it live, I was told, as an example, there's a group in Iceland who every week download a talk and listen to it in their igloo. I don't think it's an igloo, I made that up. So that's a wonderful way of using the modern media to actually spread good teachings. And so if we have computer games or movies, why can't we use that medium actually to share good values for the happiness and benefit of our kids? Venerable Sir, hindering their child from becoming a monk or nun causes their parents heavy bad karma. Someone could be very worried about her or his parents as she or he faces this kind of situations. Any situation of soothing her worry. It is bad karma to stop people doing something good, but one thing which you can do, if you're a child who wants to become a monk or a nun and your parents don't let you, don't go against your parents' permission. Just actually be very patient, be very kind, keep your aspiration very close to your heart, bring your parents to see or to hear some talks like you've heard here. And maybe when they've heard the talks and when they get more confidence that being a monk or a nun is not a great stain on their family. I remember mentioning to the Chief Reverend many years ago that here in Malaysia, everybody is so happy when a young man becomes a monk, as long as it's not their son. If it's someone else's son, oh, sadhu, 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 but not my boy. So the more you listen to Dharma, the more you understand, the more likely it is the parents will be very happy, because one of the reasons I became a monk, because I wanted some career in my life which fulfilled two objectives. Number one was actually to give me personal fulfillment and happiness, and number two, so I could help other people, so I could be of service to society. Now when I saw what a monk can do, not only to get so much inner happiness, much more inner happiness than if I was a doctor or some CEO of a big business. The personal happiness of being a monk is huge. But you also know, because of what I do here, that you have the opportunity to giving a huge amount of happiness to other people. So So look what I'm doing and how many people I'm helping. And just think, that could be your son or your daughter teaching the Dhamma for the happiness of so many people. And if you do have a child who wants to be a monk or nun, you should be so proud of them. They're actually helping the world much more than a doctor could ever do. So if you have a child who says, I want to be a monk or nun, give them the opportunity. A lot of times they'll try it out for maybe a year and they will give up. It's not for them. But now and again it is for them. And a wonderful person can help and teach in this world. There are plenty of doctors and nurses, but how many good teachers are in this world to inspire and lead and encourage and change the world? Answer. Oh, hang on. Okay. There's someone is saying here, the first four rows were not occupied, the front seats, because they were reserved for the yogis. I don't believe that. They were reserved for the ghosts. Ajahn Brahm, some if not most Chinese businessmen in Malaysia do not fully declare and pay maximum taxes to the government for a reason that these revenues are controlled by an unfairly favours Malay. That is, they are used to build mosques, surahs, or sponsor Muslim scholars in Islamic studies. Therefore, is it wise for those who pay but not fully instead reserve some monies to support good causes like Buddhist temples, stupas, or meditation centers? Thank you for advice. It is still one's obligation to follow the law of the land. And so even if one thinks it's an unjust law, an unfair law, the obligation is to try if at all possible to change the law, not to flout the law. Because if everyone started thinking the law was unjust, if I don't need to keep it, then we will lack the harmony, we will lack the togetherness, we will lack the ability to compromise and decide between us what's the fairest thing for everybody. When everyone follows their own law, we can have Islamic law, which will be for all of you, rather than just for the Islamic people, because everyone can do whatever they want. So my advice there is to bite the bullet, to pay your taxes. You usually have enough money to help the temples as well. But at the same time, you know, to see what's possible there, you know, to actually have a fairer distribution of resources. So a country does not actually think in terms of one person or another person or one religion or another religion, but treats everybody fairly, no matter who they are. But anyway, the world is never a perfect place. But at least I think we should all try and keep the law of the land. Is there such a thing called regression through meditation? Do you mean you're getting worse and worse? Or do you mean actually you're regressing to your past lives? If you mean regressing to your past lives, that's coming up in the talk, I think, on Friday night. Reincarnation. After having gone through a breakdown in my marriage, I'm seriously considering divorce as well as single parenthood. What is Buddha's view of and concerning a child? What is the Buddhist view on parenthood and conceiving a child through IVF and the sperm bank? There's nothing wrong with that at all, because by having artificial insemination, it doesn't matter, because there's still a being born in your womb. Remember, the sperm and the ovum just create the body for your child. The most important thing in the child, according to Buddhism, is a stream of consciousness which comes from the previous life. So it really doesn't matter how the vehicle is made. You know, it's a being which comes into that world with their own past karma. And the way, as parents or a single parent, you look after that child. Now, because single parenthood is becoming more common in our modern world for many, many reasons, I've known some single parents who are wonderful mothers or fathers, and they can really look after their child, and their child is a wonderful child. So it seems to be more helpful to have two parents, a mother and a father. It's harder work doing it by yourself, but it's not impossible. So basically, there's no great impediment there, but you have to think, if you're going to have a child, you know, as a single mother, are you able to look after that child? Have you got the resources of time, especially, to care and give that child all the emotional support it needs? So there's no obvious restriction there, but just many considerations you should think about first. Dear Ajahn Brahm, here's a much better question. If you can't see a ghost, how do you know there is one in your house? Sometimes things move. Sometimes you hear sounds. Sometimes one of my favorite ghosts in Perth, you know he's there because he likes watching the TV. What happens? The family has told me this many, many times. They're watching their favorite program on the TV, and the channel switches by itself to another program. They take out the remote control and they turn it back to the program they were watching. A second or two later, it goes back to the other program. Now they know it's the ghost. The ghost likes watching TV. The ghosts have their own remote control, and they will watch what they want to watch. So now that family have bought another TV just for the ghost. So they can watch what they want, ghost can watch what he wants. That's true, happens. Another ghost in Perth. We've got some really neat ghosts in Perth. We must have them over here in KL as well. But this particular ghost, he was a former owner of the house who, while taking the furniture out while he was moving, carried a heavy sofa, had a heart attack right in front of the door, and died right there. And his ghost is still there. At least it was a year or two ago. And he always wants to try and come into his house. The new owners are a title. That's why they told me about this. They know about ghosts, so they're not really afraid. But that ghost kept on ringing the doorbell. And they would open the door and no one was there. They thought it might be a child playing a game, but sometimes the door rang and they opened it immediately. There's no way a child could run away and hide. It's a ghost. They've seen that ghost as well. The owner of the house had a brainwave. He decided to disconnect the electricity from the doorbell to take out the batteries. But did it work? No. Ghosts have their own power supply. And this ghost has no batteries. He still makes the bell ring. Really neat, these ghosts these days. So that's how you know there's a ghost there. If the television channel changes, if doorbells ring when there's no batteries inside, that's cool. But the ghosts don't harm anyone, they're just living beings. The saying goes, love your enemy or someone you don't like. Please enlighten me on this matter. How can you love an enemy? You can love an enemy by seeing their Buddha nature. In other words, seeing something inside of them which is worthy of love. You only hate someone if you think there's no redeeming qualities in them. If you think they're all bad. And the first step to loving your enemy is realizing, no matter how cruel they've been to you, other people actually love them. and care for them. Other people see something in your enemy which you haven't seen. And once you see their lovable qualities, it's very hard to have them as your enemy anymore. And that's how you begin to forgive the faults of your enemy and begin to love them. And that's how you begin to love the enemy inside of you. There's part of you which is called the enemy, the part you don't like. There are too many people who have a lack of self-esteem who don't like themselves because you have done something you'd rather not have done. And you feel guilty and you don't want to forgive yourself. The first step of loving yourself, which for many people is enemy number one, is to see something inside of you worthy of love. When you see the beautiful part in you, then you can forgive the other part. When you see something beautiful in your enemy, only then can you forgive them. That's the first step. See something worthy of love. Otherwise, you'd always be punishing yourself and punishing others. They've hurt me, they need to be punished. There is no such thing as punishment in Buddhism. Many years ago, in my monastery in Perth, a trainee monk broke a rule. They went into the kitchen in the afternoon and made themselves a sandwich. That's breaking precepts. He wasn't a monk yet, he was training to be a monk, wearing white, keeping 8 precepts. So he came up to me to confess. He was very ashamed. He'd eaten in the afternoon and broken his precepts. So I said, it's good that you confess. Don't do it again. You can go now. And he said, that's not enough. Because I'm afraid if you don't punish me, Ajahn Brahm, I'll probably do it again. He said, no, forgive yourself. Just learn from your mistakes. There's no punishment in Buddhism. He said, no. Give me some sort of penance to help me remember this, so I'll never do it again. Many people, they want to be punished if they made a mistake, because they feel guilty. And I'd just been reading a book about the history of Australia. Many of you know that Australia was colonized by the British, and they sent many of their prisoners to begin the first colonies in Australia. And those prisoners were treated very, very cruelly. When they made a mistake, they were whipped. And having just read that, I thought that might be a good idea for this young monk. So I told him, okay, if you want a punishment, I'm going to give you 50 strokes of the cat. And this Anagarika, this man in white, he was wearing white, but his face went whiter than his clothes. He was really red. He thought, oh my goodness, Ajahn Brahm's going to whip me. 50 strokes, that's going to hurt. And then I said, in this monastery, 50 strokes of the cat means you have to find the monastery cat and stroke it 50 times. That's what we mean by 50 strokes of the cat. You have to learn some compassion and kindness. And what better way to learn compassion than find a little pet fluffy cat and stroking it and seeing it purr. So that was the penance, to learn compassion, not to be. So that's how we forgive. Forgive our enemies and also forgive ourselves. If ever you feel very, very guilty and want punishing, go and find a cat and give yourself 50 strokes. Last question. I had a slight depression and always feeling the muscle tightness over the head. It made me restless and sometimes unbearable.
Can meditation help in this condition? How to do it? I'm thinking of becoming a monk for a short duration of period. Could I have the contact of any monastery in Thailand? Thank you. It sure works if you tackle depression with cognitive therapy, in other words, good attitudes, and also with meditation. I think I mentioned that the former Premier of Western Australia, Dr. Jeff Gallop, who resigned being Premier of Western Australia 12 months ago when he was staying for the Christmas New Year period with his friend Tony Blair. He was Tony Blair and Cherie Blair's best man at their wedding. They were Oxford together. Now he's the Premier of Western Australia. He was, and he gave up 12 months ago because of depression. At Chequers, the country house of Tony Blair, last Christmas, he realized that he had clinical depression. And so he came back to Western Australia, called a press conference and resigned. He was a very prominent Australian. After resigning from politics, he rested a while and now he's got a professorship in the University of Sydney. He was the most prominent sufferer of depression in the whole of that country. 2 weeks ago he gave a talk in Sydney about depression. He opened his talk by saying, "Let me begin with a quote from my good friend Ajahn Brahm in his book, Opening the Door of Your Heart." And he continued his talk quoting many times from my book and how that such Eastern philosophy and meditation had helped him through his depression. This works to get you through the worst depressions and also all the other problems of life. And so, that book can help, meditation helps, good attitudes help, so you never need to get depressed ever again. You can laugh at your problems instead of allowing those problems to cause you to be miserable. And one of the great teachings to get rid of depression, if ever you are sad, you get up in the morning, you're having a hard time, always remember what my first meditation teacher taught me. I was a student at the time. He saw I wasn't that happy at that time. He asked me, "When you get up in the morning, what's the first thing you do?" I said, "I go to the toilet." He said, "Marvelous. Is there a mirror in your toilet?" I said, "Sure there is. What are you saying that for?" And he told me, "When you first get up in the morning, before you go to the loo, look at yourself in the mirror and smile at yourself." And I said, "Sir, I'm a student. I stay up late at night. When I get up in the morning, I'd be afraid to look at myself, the state I was in." He said, "Look at yourself and smile. And if you can't manage a natural smile, get out your two fingers like this." Come on, get your two fingers out, everybody. Put them on the side of your mouth and push up. And I followed that for 2 years. Every morning as a student, even if I had a hangover, even if I felt really tired, I'd get up, go to the bathroom, get my two fingers out and make a face. And so I laughed at myself every morning for 2 years. Somehow or other that stuck. That's a wonderful, very easy way to overcome depression. Laugh at yourself. So thank you this evening for listening to the talk, and especially all those questions, which we managed to get through most of them tonight. So now we'll do the sharing of merits before we go. Are you ready?
Itam men yachimam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yachimam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Itam men yachimam hotu Sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu.
Sadhu. Sadhu.
Very good. Thank you for those three sadhus. And maybe see you tomorrow night, where the talk tomorrow night is going to be... happiness. After happiness. Happiness upon happiness. Upon happiness, how many happinesses are there? Only two. No, okay, let's put another one on there. Special offer for tomorrow. Happiness upon happiness upon happiness. Very good.
Sangham.